You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, on the show, we're returning to the topic of education. Listeners will know I've had a number of guests on over the weeks and months talking about education in New Zealand, everything from the behavioural issues of students to the curriculum and everything else in between, and of course, academic freedom. So I'm delighted today to have Dr. Michael Johnston along. He's a senior fellow at the New Zealand Initiative. If you look him up, you will see there is a list as long as my arm of his academic abilities and criteria. Amongst many things, he has a PhD in cognitive psychology. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael, you've been prolific in the best sense of that word, writing about education in New Zealand across a whole wide spectrum of issues. So, I'm just going to start with a major big question. Is what's your take of the state of education in New Zealand? And I'm thinking in the first instance, particularly around our primary and secondary schools. We'll get to universities and tertiary a bit later. But yeah, what's your sense of the state of education in New Zealand at the moment?
Over the last 20 years or so, we've undergone quite a precipitous decline in quite a number of the important aspects of education, especially in the primary and secondary sector. I mean, the universities as well have gone into decline, and we can talk about that. But just at the compulsory end of the primary and secondary, I see really three main pillars of the system. There are things that hang off those things, but the curriculum is one. The quality of the teaching profession is another, and that has obviously goes to how teachers are trained. And the third thing, the third big one, is how our schools are organised on a national basis. And I think all three of those things have had major problems. Certainly the Minister for Education, Erica Stanford, over the last year has been working pretty hard on the curriculum side of things. And I'm very supportive of that work. As some listeners may know and others won't, I've been involved in that work to an extent. And so there's a limited extent to which I can discuss that, but what is known is that next year there'll be new knowledge-rich curricula available, in fact, being implemented in our primary schools for English and mathematics, and that will change the way literacy is taught towards a more structured approach. It's certainly true that many schools have already moved in that direction, in fact, so I think the literacy thing is starting to turn around after a really long time. And that to me is absolutely key because, you know, the ability to read and write is vital to accessing the entire curriculum later on. So getting that right is really important. And probably, you know, the mathematics is also really important for many other subjects.
Can you just give us a quick illustration, just tease out what you mean around not only a structured curriculum, God, I'm getting tongue-tied with my English, a structured curriculum, but also a knowledge-rich, because these are terms that flow out quite quickly, but to the layman, just give us a bit of a sense of what it looks like, if you will, at the moment, or it has been, to why yes. It needs to be knowledge-rich.
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, a knowledge-rich curriculum is one. I mean, it's related to the idea of it being structured. So it means that the subjects are based on disciplines that have been honed over, you know, decades, centuries, in some cases millennia. If you think about mathematics, for example, I mean, it has many roots in the ancient Greek world, in the Arabic world, from India, China, you know, all of these cultures have contributed to this structure of knowledge, which is incredibly powerful. Likewise, science, you know, again, it has many cultural roots from many different parts of the world, but it's coalesced into this way of testing theories with evidence that is unprecedented in history. And it's one of the reasons why we live in such a prosperous time, because science has built up this incredible amount of knowledge that then feeds into technology that results in huge benefits to human beings. So at the school level, we have subjects that are distilled from these disciplines like mathematics, science, history, literature, and many other things. And they're structured in such a way to make them accessible to young people. So that means building up knowledge in stages. Any sophisticated knowledge structure, young people are not going to discover it on their own. It needs to be explicitly taught. This is one of the ways we've gone a bit wrong in the last couple of decades. We've had this idea of, you know, child-led learning or student-led learning. Now, it's good to honour young people's interests and to try to use those as hooks. But in the end, these discipline-based subjects need to be explicitly taught by knowledgeable teachers or they won't be learned. So a knowledge-rich curriculum is one that gives teachers the background support that they need to do that. It orders the knowledge in a logical way. It's really clear and it's got plenty of knowledge in it. It's not leaving it to teachers or students to make up for themselves. And if you compare our current curriculum with what's going to be available just for primary school English and mathematics, well, each of those new documents is a much thicker one than the entirety of the year 0 to 13 current New Zealand curriculum. So teachers will have far more knowledge specified and it will be well ordered and sequenced. So that's what's meant by a knowledge-rich curriculum.
I'm sort of figuratively waving my hands in the air in support of what you're saying. Again, I'm a layman compared to yourself. And I better clear my head. My wife's a teacher as well. Amazing. But I'm struck by two things you've just said there. One is this idea that somehow the students have them, and it's my language here, the students somehow have all the knowledge inside them already rather than something to be imparted or shared. And the other is that there is a rich tradition and knowledge that actually we can allow the teachers not to have to recreate the wheel. It's one thing I've seen through my wife is the requirement to, and she's a math and science teacher. She's the smart one in this relationship, Michael. I'm only the student of philosophy. But she's always having to recreate the wheel. And you go, well, why is that necessary? And this has been right across the country. There's a corpus of knowledge we can tap into and use.
It's really quite absurd and puts far too much of a workload on teachers unnecessarily, of course. Why would, as you say, they reinvent or replicate different mathematics curricula across the country? For sure, you can have local variations, and that's fine. So the national curriculum is a pretty rich framework, but it leaves room for teachers to tailor it to the kids in front of them and their interests and their local concerns and so on. But it ensures that teachers have a really strong framework wherever they are in the country. And so that's a really important aspect of it, so they can get on with teaching it and don't have to spend a lot of time developing it.
Well, I'd make the argument they'd probably be able to be even more effective as teachers in that local context if they weren't having to do that wheel recreation. They'd be less stressed, more time to actually adapt it, which probably brings us to that second point that you mentioned. So we've talked about the curriculum, the quality of teachers, and I remember a few months ago, and I've forgotten where it came from, but a number of our teachers, unfortunately, particularly in maths and science, but even English, weren't even reaching an NCEA level one. I think I've written a note to myself here, like almost a quarter of teachers did not get NCEA level one in, say, math, and they're meant to be teaching it. So you touched on teacher quality. Was that an element of what's at stake here or problematic?
So, you know, I want to talk about this fairly sensitively because this is not an indictment on individual teachers. In fact, they've been sold short by their training in very many cases. So it's not them to blame, and they deserve every support because they do a very, very difficult job. We've got something like a third of our teachers burning out in the first few years in the classroom, and that's an indictment not on them but on the system that's trained them, which is largely the university system. So 90-something percent of our teachers, both primary and secondary, come out of university programs. There are a couple of really good quality programs that are not university run, but that's a very small market share at the moment. So what's wrong with our university teacher training system? Well, for one thing, teachers in training spend too little time in the classroom, and they learn at university a lot of theory, which is not very well based in evidence and not very well connected to what they do practically in the classroom. On the other hand, they don't learn enough, remotely enough, in terms of classroom management skills, which is where it all needs to start if you want to have a functional classroom. Teachers have to be able to control the classroom and know what to do when kids are, you know, making things chaotic. We've got situations in our classrooms that are sometimes violent, and teachers are not given much support or equipment to deal with that. All they can do a lot of the time is evacuate the classroom. You might have kids throwing chairs around. What is a teacher going to do? They're basically not allowed to touch the child. All they can do is get the other kids out so that it's safe, and that disrupts everybody, obviously. It takes a chunk out of the day. So that's where it needs to start, is with really strong classroom management skills. And from there, how to teach in a structured way, things like reading. And you mentioned mathematics. I mean, that's certainly an issue. There was a report published by the Royal Society Te Aparangi about 3 years ago, from a committee chaired by Professor Gavin Martin, who's a distinguished professor of mathematics. And they found, you know, our primary school teachers, by and large, have a bit of a fear of mathematics themselves. Their knowledge is not terribly strong, and they're not confident to teach it to young people. So why is that? Why are we enabling that to happen? I mean, in part, it might be screening in the first instance, who gets to go into a primary training program. In fact, one of the things the government's done this year is to require teachers going into primary school training to have 14 credits at level two in mathematics. So that's a really good prerequisite. It will ensure that at least the teachers have some ground knowledge in mathematics, but also we need more focus on how to teach it during the training. There's just not enough. It's quite a difficult subject to teach if you're not that confident with it, and we get into this vicious circle where a generation of teachers have themselves been poorly taught at school, and then they're scared of mathematics. Lots of adults are anxious about mathematics, and it's
big. Yeah, well, this radio host is one of them. I'm not bad at maths, but my God, even just thinking about it freaks me out.
Well, this is the thing, because it's quite a tragedy, really. Because, I mean, this can happen with any subject, but it's especially likely to happen with mathematics because of all the things that we learn at school. It's probably the most hierarchical in terms of its concepts, right? One thing is built on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. And if at any point you kind of fall off the wagon and miss out because it's going too quickly or because there's something you just don't get, then everything that comes after that is going to be shaky. And so there's not enough attention paid to where kids are experiencing what we call cognitive overload, which is essentially an overload of short-term memory. So one of the really important things in all teaching, but especially complex subjects like mathematics, is to ensure that each step is firmly encoded in long-term memory before we try to build on it, because that then frees up those short-term resources to be able to take the next step. And
yeah, I've been struck observing some of the classrooms. This is beyond my family connections, just having, you know, traveled around. I've been struck with the mathematics teaching, so much focus on asking the students, how do you want to solve this problem? Whereas being a little bit biased myself, I was like, actually, as you said, we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of years that this is how you're going to do. Well, actually, the Fibonacci sequence is probably not so good for secondary school, but you know, this is how we do it, and it's the rote learning. Dare I say that's probably a bad word.
Simple multiplication, something like simple multiplication. You want to or addition. You want to teach kids one really simple way to do it. You know, column addition is good. It's pretty traditional. And it works. And importantly, the method itself doesn't impose more cognitive complication than it needs to. So you want to leave all the cognitive resources available to actually learn the core concept. if the method of teaching is itself complicated, then you're unnecessarily complicating the process of learning. So, yes, one simple method to do each thing and clearly taught and practiced enough so that it's committed to long-term memory, that is the way to do it.
And I suspect, it says me to the man with the doctorate, but cognitively that will be good not only for the student but for the teacher as well, less stress.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Before we get onto the university or the tertiary sector, you did also mention about the organisation of our schools having an impact. Did you want to just sort of tease that out a little bit for us?
Yeah, so this is something I've been thinking about quite a lot of late. So going back to 1989, we have self-governing schools. Every school in the country is a crown entity. They each have a board, and essentially each school is directly accountable to the state. Now, that works really well for some schools, in particular those located in areas where they can constitute boards who are mostly made up of parents, you know, who might have communities of lawyers and accountants and the professions. They can put together boards which are pretty functional, and then there are other communities where that's not so much so. And so we have a lot of inequality in terms of the governance of our schools because of that. So that's one aspect. And then if we start to think also about how teacher training might be done better, well, there's a model being run by some schools in Auckland at the moment where the schools themselves own a teaching qualification and they train teachers in school. And they do, you know, the coursework online. Now, to me, this is a really good model. It's a kind of apprenticeship model of teaching. They get the theory they need, and it's closely aligned to what they're doing in the classroom under the supervision of a skilled teacher. So I'm thinking about a model where we have communities of schools that are accountable to the state as an entity. So, and I haven't fully thought this through yet, but the kind of idea is that these communities of schools could be running teacher training. We could make sure that each community of schools had wealthier schools and less wealthy schools, so that is, you know, serving communities across the socioeconomic spectrum, so that the resources that are inherent in the more well-off communities are shared around more, and we reduce the inequality associated with your postcode when it comes to education. So that could help with governance. It could help with teacher training. These could also be the organisations that allocate resources like special education services, where they're required, educational psychologists and the like, rather than having to wait for the ministry to allocate them across the country. So the idea is to devolve a lot of the things that the ministry does now, but does pretty inefficiently, to a more local level in terms of a community of schools. And importantly, these would not be branches of the ministry, but in fact, you know, groups of schools that are run by the senior management of the schools concerned. So they would have the resources and be able to allocate them and be accountable to the state for the performance of the community of schools rather than necessarily every individual school. And that way they're incentivized to look after the schools that are struggling within their communities. And it could run professional development for teachers, and, you know, teachers who are really good at certain things could be seconded perhaps to run that for a time. This is the kind of idea that I'm thinking about. It needs to be fleshed out, still in early days, so your listeners have heard it first.
There we go. Well, of course, your primary research and work is in education. As you know, there's always been little hints of this cooperation already. You just mentioned that collection of schools around its
Well, we have Kaliako as they stand, but they're pretty loose. And I'm talking about something with a bit more structure behind it. Yeah.
Which makes sense too from I often talk about the principle of subsidiarity. In other words, you know, putting or delegating authority to the appropriate level and having everything centralised through Wellington has never made much sense to me. Hey, jumping then into the university or tertiary sector, when I look at the various reports that come out, New Zealand's, we're sliding, Michael. We're going backwards, it seems. But your impressions of what is happening and why?
Do you mean in our universities?
Yeah, in the university or certainly the tertiary space.
Yeah, I mean, I think The universities have been declining for a long time. And, you know, I put it down to two seemingly quite different causes. I mean, one is that we commercialized our universities from the late 1980s onwards. This is when we started charging fees and having student loans and all of that. Now, this is certainly a strong argument for students paying some fees. I'm not necessarily opposed to that because it is a public good to get a good education because then you're contributing to the country and the economy. But at the same time, it's also a private good. You know, you're getting a benefit that increases your income in the long term. So asking students to make a contribution to that is not necessarily a bad thing. But at the same time as commercializing them, and as part of commercializing them, we vastly expanded the number of people that go to university. And I'm just not sure that everybody is well served by that. It might be that we need to rebalance things a bit in terms of the extent to which young people think of university versus, say, a trade. Now, if you're talking about income, being an electrician or a plumber or a builder, you can make really good money. You can go on to start your own business. There's all sorts of opportunities that opens up. So I'm not saying that we should, you know, tell young people what to do. In fact, quite the opposite. Just open up the choices and make it a bit clearer what those choices could be, rather than just assuming that university is the best. And well, I think there's a bit of cultural snobbery involved with it, to be honest. So, now in terms of what's gone wrong with the university, so the commercialization is one thing, and I think that's led to a very kind of customer-focused kind of way of thinking about it. So a sort of bums-on-seats model where they get as many students in as they can and return for funding from the government. And so it's just kind of driven the numbers up and up, but hasn't done good things to quality. I can certainly say, you know, from my recent experience as an academic, I was at Victoria University in the education faculty for 10 years in the 2010s. It's very difficult to fail students. You get kind of wrapped over the knuckle. If you fail anyone who, you know, turned up and handed in all the assignments, no matter how poorly they might have done. And so the quality of our degrees has definitely been eroded. We also have a free speech crisis on our campuses. We've had instances of speakers like Don Brash being banned from our campuses. Massey University banned Don Brash, and there have been other similar incidents. There's a report from the New Zealand Initiative a couple of months ago by my colleague Dr. James Kierstead, who has compiled a huge amount of evidence that we have a problem with academic freedom. That is, you know, the ability of academics to speak their mind on a range of issues. And that's actually part of their job. It's enshrined in the Education and Training Act, academic freedom, and it's so that academics can act as the critic and conscience of society. But if you're in a position where you fear for your job, if you speak out on certain issues that are in a manner that doesn't accord with what the university management wants to hear, then we have a real problem with that. And there's certainly a censorious attitude amongst some of the university leaders at the moment that needs to be addressed.
Well, I follow this quite closely. The freedom of speech is one of my big soapboxes. And I certainly see a lot of the universities, as you say, quite censorious. We know with the various research and studies that are being done. I think the Free Speech Union, for example, come out and saying that academics just won't touch on cultural issues, gender issues, identity issues, the treaty. Yep. But we do seem to have simultaneously, Michael, the universities in general, there are a few outliers who are also trying to codify through their code of conduct. And, well, long and short, they're trying to codify very particular views on issues such as the treaty or a safetyism approach, which doesn't seem very healthy.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things there. So what you're talking about is, so universities should be neutral venues for the discussion of ideas. In other words, they should adopt institutional neutrality. That is to say, universities shouldn't themselves have an official position on the treaty, on, you know, gender issues or anything else. They should be venues where open debates can take place so that academics can, and others who are invited to speak on campuses by members of the university, can present their arguments. Now, naturally, they should present those arguments with as much evidence as they can muster, because that makes their arguments stronger. But then the way it works is other people get to disagree with you and present their own evidence and contest your evidence. And nobody should be ruled out at the very start by saying, we think you're a promulgator of misinformation or something. I detest that word. I mean, there are ideas and there are better ideas, and the best way to deal with a bad idea is to debate it properly. It's not to shut it down from the very start saying, we know that's wrong. Because, I mean, we were talking about science before. One of the reasons that science is such a strong way of improving our understanding of the world is that it holds all theories to be wrong ultimately. And we try to find the theory that is least wrong. That is the one that fits with the evidence the best at the moment. And so the way scientific advancement works is that scientists conduct experiments and other studies, and they present their evidence in terms of arguing for a theory that best accommodates the evidence, and other scientists will contest that. And so the whole thing is an ongoing argument and a refinement of ideas. And occasionally you have a huge shift in understanding of a particular thing. And so that needs to take place in a really untrammeled way for it to be effective. So we won't get a better picture of the truth if we shut down arguments, even if we think they're stupid or ill-motivated in the first instance. We've got to allow people to have the idea. And if it's a terrible idea, then we tear it down. But the debate must take place.
It's been certainly one of the worries I've observed anecdotally from my own time at university many, many years ago to, you know, when I go onto campus and give talks these days on different topics, including, God of all things, foreign affairs. But it is that censorious element which kicks in, and it's just like, here at a university?
But as you work on lots of different levels, right? A lot of it's cultural, and that's a real problem. So, you know, there's a great book written a few years ago by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt called The Coddling of the American Mind, and they'd noticed an increasing psychological fragility in young people. They're both at universities, and they've noticed that their undergraduates are getting less and less resilient to hearing ideas that, you know, maybe offended them or upset them. Now, part of university training ought to be to make students more resilient and able to debate ideas, because, yes, debates can be bruising. It can be difficult to hear ideas that kind of conflict with what we already understand. But that's actually one of the things that university education is for. Now, Lukianoff and Haidt, you know, went back to kind of risk-averse parenting and the way in which children are not exposed to enough risk when they're younger. Obviously, you don't want to overdo it, and we want them to be safe, but they do need to be able to take risks, both physically and intellectually, as they grow up, in order to fully mature and develop that ability to be resilient. And the other thing that they lighted on was social media and the way in which that causes people to fall into echo chambers and to start to really just hate people who they disagree with. And that's a very corrosive thing. And I think that kind of culture has got its hooks in pretty deeply. So how you turn around a cultural problem like that is not trivial. We can put in place rules, you know, saying universities must be institutionally neutral. They can't shut people down, et cetera, et cetera. But if that culture is not adopted, as it were, intrinsically by students and staff in universities, really we've got a problem, and we'll have an ongoing problem. So it's a difficult one.
It is, and look, I'm pleased you share that, because I'm sort of a less rules, less regulation type guy, which is ironic for someone who's been in Parliament. But you're right. I think, you know, the more we try to regulate this into the university, and there is, I think, a place for it, because where
there's
we
a place
are, but it is, as you say, something much deeper, and how to change that culture. Michael, I better wrap it up there. Look, this has been, I have to say, absolutely fascinating, and covering quite a lot, but knowing that there's a whole lot more to discuss. But can I just say thank you for your time this morning, but also for all the work that you are doing. If listeners want to engage further and find out more of your research, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, they can come on the New Zealand Initiative website. Just Google New Zealand Initiative and you'll find us straight away. And all our reports are there, both mine and James Kirsted's, who's now done a couple of reports on the universities, and all the other reports that our research fellows publish on different aspects of New Zealand society and economy and culture.
Fantastic. Well, I encourage listeners to do that. So, look, Michael, thanks again for your time.
It's a great pleasure, Simon.
So that was Dr. Michael Johnston. He's a senior fellow at the New Zealand Initiative.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.